Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, March 16th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt named Caracourt champion, what that recognition really means, and Klamath National Forest to begin spring underburning. Stay tuned, those stories and more, coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
California's new Caracourt system, the state's major push to address serious mental illness and chronic homelessness, is still in its early months. But Humboldt County has already been recognized as one of 10 Caracourt champions statewide. To understand what that means and what it took to get there, we spoke with Paul Bugnacki, one of the deputy directors at Behavioral Health for Humboldt County's Department of Health and Human Services Behavioral Health Bridge.
Caracourt is a civil court proceeding where certain people could petition the court to have somebody engaged in mental health services, and really targeting specific individuals that are suffering from schizophrenia and schizophrenia spectrum disorders, including bipolar 1 disorder with psychotic features. That was a new addition more recently. The governor is the governor's initiative. It's part of his overhaul for behavioral health system, and also to address chronic issues of homelessness and mental health and substance use disorders that are prevalent throughout the state.
He says the model is based on assisted outpatient treatment, also known as Laura's Law, but with a key difference.
It's a proceeding that a judge oversees, and it's a voluntary program, so nobody's forced into treatment. And the hope is that individuals will engage in treatment, will agree to take medications, and hopefully to help get them housed if they are unhoused or have housing instability, just to help to elevate their overall quality of life.
Humboldt wasn't in the first wave of counties required to launch Caracourt, but Bugnacki says they have used that time to study what worked and what didn't in the early cohort.
Humboldt County, we were part of the cohort 2 that implemented later after the governor initially started this initiative. Initially, there were 7 counties that were part of the first cohort. So Humboldt County was really paying attention to those 7 cohorts. Counties and learning from them. And it took us about a year of regular meetings with our partners from the court, our public defender's office, our district attorney's office, our behavioral health county council, and program staff to really try to figure out how we were going to implement this in our county.
The county set a go-live date of December 2024, but the biggest challenge was simple. There was no money for staffing.
This CARE Act really didn't come with designated funding for new positions for behavioral health. So we really had to be creative and with our resources on how we were going to stand this up. So that first year was a lot of administrative work to put together a process that was going to work for us in our county.
They blended Caracourt into an existing conservatorship calendar and relied heavily on collaboration.
We had incredible support from our county council, Heather Duran, who really helped to find solutions on working with our public defenders, Luke Brownfield, to come up with processes and that would fit into our court process, our civil court process, that wasn't going to be too onerous. So we kind of blended this into an existing court calendar for our LPS conservatorship calendar at the courts. So we really worked hard to try to find solutions to make things work that were easy because we're using existing staff in behavioral health. So that means we're pulling them away from other programs that they are still working in to also really focus in on providing the Caracourt required elements, which include court time, a lot of data reporting, which is really significant and substantial and incredibly time-consuming to capture this data that the state's wanting and reporting that.
Jacob Rosen, a licensed marriage and family therapist and the managing mental health clinician for Crisis Alternative Response of Eureka, added that collaboration isn't just happening at the county level, but also on the ground in Eureka.
Everyone has really come together to collaborate on these cases that really need a little more attention and work. And I mean, we're seeing the fruit of that, right? And you know, the proof is in the pudding when, you know, we're getting, you know, named care champions by the governor.
That teamwork is what led the state to name Humboldt one of the 10 care court champions. The designation comes with access to more than $3 million in housing-related funds. But Bagnacki says the recognition doesn't change their approach.
Before we went live with it, we had already identified quite a few folks that we thought would be petitioned in for care court to start with. So we did a little legwork early on in preparation for that. And I think that helped with our numbers because, you know, most of those out of the gate were our own referrals from our own department.
Once the program launched, petitions began coming in from far beyond county staff.
Once we started to get the word out to people in their community, I think we started to see more petitions coming from elsewhere, community partners, and we're even getting referrals and petitions from the state hospital, from hospitals, and even family members. So family members are petitioning for their loved one to be involved in care court.
The program is still new, but Humboldt's early numbers show both the scale of the need and the complexity of the process.
We've had 57 total petitions received. We've had about 21 that are active and another 21 that have been dismissed. And we've had one or two graduations. And then we have about 14 that are going through the initial petition process.
That early phase can take time, sometimes just locating the person who's been petitioned.
That initial petition process a lot of times takes a lot of time, a lot of outreach and engagement for the individual. Sometimes we have to find the person that's getting petitioned, and we also have to serve them a notice. So there's a lot of things that need to happen in that early phase of care court.
The county can bill the state for some of that work, but only some.
We are tracking those and pulling down dollars as we can. I think we've had close to $25,000 in claims so far that we've submitted to the state from behavioral health. The court has their own process for submitting for some reimbursements for their costs. I don't have those figures, but so there are some funds available for care court and care act, but no new funds for allocations of staff or anything like that. I would say it's underfunded, not unfunded.
And why are petitions dismissed?
There could be a lot of reasons. One could be they don't qualify. Maybe they don't have a qualifying diagnosis. Another might be that they say, thanks for the offer, but no thanks. I'm good on my own, and they could refuse. Another reason could be that they re-engage in outpatient services, so there's not a need for a court proceeding because they're engaged in treatment. So there's just a number, and sometimes we just can't find people.
Despite the new funding tied to the Care Court Champion designation, Bagnacki says Humboldt isn't planning to expand the program, at least not yet.
We're going to just continue our efforts that we're doing now. I don't think we're planning on doing any expansion efforts. I mean, we'll continue our efforts to educate the community and point them to our website and other supports so that they can learn about Care Court and also learn how to file a petition and what that process looks like. We'll continue to engage with our housing partners in some of our own programs, like the HOME program that DHHS has is really an important partner in this effort to help with getting folks housed and to access some of that housing money, the HHAP money that the governor was talking about. We'll be trying to tap into as much of that as possible. You know, we are hoping to hire one staff to help with filing court papers and doing a lot of the court proceedings activities. We're interested in having that happen this coming year, but we're really still using just existing staff to hold up this program. And we'll continue to support other counties that reach out for support, and or we're happy to help in any way that we can. If we have time to do that, we'll certainly help them.
Rosen says the staffing challenge is one of the biggest barriers to long-term success.
For clients that require this level of care, they require a lot of care. And so if there isn't funding for positions specifically to provide that treatment, it can be difficult for, you know, the behavioral health agencies across the state to allocate staff time that's really needed for that level of care.
Bagnacki says the county's early successes are the result of a team effort.
I really think that a big part of these successes has to do with the teams that we're working with, both our clinician, Jordan Lampe, our clinical supervisor, Megan Sheeran, has been really supportive and helpful in this effort. Our partners, I've already mentioned, our county counsel, Heather Durand, and public defender, Luke Brownfield, and also Judge Canning, all have been just amazing, and I think really have helped make this a success here in Humboldt.
Rosen says the Humboldt size and its willingness to collaborate has made a difference.
Humboldt's in a unique position where we're big enough to be able to pull a collaboration like that together, but we're not so big that, you know, it's difficult to build consensus because you have, you know, hundreds of agencies with thousands of staff all trying to get in alignment. We're able to get consensus pretty quickly here when, you know, we all sit down in a room and start working together and meeting because there aren't that many players. And so I think we have a unique advantage in some respects in that way, but I also think that everyone's just worked really, really hard, and hats off to the county behavioral health system, especially in the work that they've been doing in the CareCourt program.
CareCourt is still in its infancy, both statewide and here in Humboldt County. As the state continues to push for new approaches to mental health and homelessness, counties like Humboldt are showing what early implementation looks like: complicated, collaborative, and still evolving. This week, the Forest Service is getting ready to ignite two prescribed burn units as part of the East Fork Scott Project. Fire managers say it's work that protects communities, strengthens forests, and reduces the risk of catastrophic wildfires. To understand how it all works, KMUD spoke with Jennifer Erickson, the Forest Fire Prevention Officer and Public Information Officer for the Klamath National Forest. She says the team is gearing up for a very specific assignment.
The project that we're going to be working on in the coming days is the East Fork Scott project, and we have a couple separate units that we are looking at burning. They're in the area of Masterson Loop and Hayden Ridge.
The process starts long before anyone lights a drip torch. Erickson says every prescribed burn begins with a detailed plan, one that blends fire science, weather modeling, and on-the-ground preparation.
You know, a burn plan is, we'll write a burn plan. Well, first we'll identify an area that needs some attention that can benefit from prescribed fire. So our fuels folks will write a burn plan. They'll do some fire modeling using some software to determine what the ideal weather prescription, environmental prescription is going to be. They'll identify their staffing needs, and they'll start working towards implementing that plan once it's approved.
Once the plan is approved, the real groundwork begins, literally. Crews carve out fuel breaks, improve roads, and install remote weather stations to monitor conditions in real time.
After we get a burn plan identified and moving, we'll prepare a unit. Generally, it's by putting in fuel breaks, whether it's hand line or improving existing features out there like roads. We'll put in a remote access weather station to monitor on-site weather in real time. When we believe we're going to start to meet those environmental parameters like temperature and relative humidity and winds, then we'll start to notify our partners and the public that we're planning to burn. When we get the ideal weather parameters, that's the prescription.
When the weather lines up, not too dry, not too windy, the team begins with a test fire. It's a small ignition designed to answer one question: will the fire behave the way the plan expects?
When we fall within that prescription and we're confident that we're going to remain in that, then we will go out and start a test fire. And, you know, the test fire happens when all of the people who are staffing the burn are in place. The weather is written down, the fuel moisture is written down, and then we look to see what a small area of fire is going to do, whether it's going to meet our objectives, like, is it going to consume the surface fuels? Is it going to burn more actively than we want? So if it does, if it's not meeting the objectives of the burn plan, then we will cease ignitions, mop that up, and wait for another time.
When the test fire behaves as expected, the full operation begins. Erickson says it's a coordinated effort involving multiple teams, each with a specific role.
When we have a successful test fire, then we will proceed with implementing the burn. There's a burn boss identified. There's a holding boss with a group of people, like some fire engines, hand crews working for them, and a firing group. And each of those groups has a specific tasks that they are responsible for. And then the firing group generally lays fire in a certain way that will achieve the desired intensity of fire. So we might use strips or dots, and that's with using a drip torch. It's a fine balance in getting the desired intensity with how much fire you put on the ground. So we'll do that. It generally takes about a operational period for the size of the units that we're looking at out there to complete the ignitions. We will remain on site for a while, mopping up the edges and monitoring. And then we pretty much are there for the next, you know, few days, securing those lines, patrolling, monitoring, and we'll continue to patrol those burns until we call them out.
The burns planned for this week are relatively modest in size. 72 acres in one unit and 42 in another. Erickson says each can be completed in a single operational period.
The ignition period for these prescribed burns, you know, one of the units is 72 acres, one is 42 acres. Both of those should be able to be completed within an operational period each. So generally we'll get out to the unit in the morning, wait for the weather parameters to get in place, hopefully be burning by 10 or 11, depending on the conditions. And then we are generally done, you know, by late afternoon, early evening. So during that time period when ignitions are happening.
People will see smoke, but Erickson says the team works hard to keep it predictable, safe, and well communicated.
People will be able to see our smoke when we're lighting out there, probably just about anywhere in the Scott Valley. Anyone traveling on Highway 3 or the Gazelle Callahan Road will be able to see smoke. Top smoke could be visible from the Shasta Valley side, so that's the I-5 side. There'll be a ridge in between. We put signage out on roads that will be very visible to anybody traveling in the area. We put the signs where people will likely first start to see the smoke so that they know that it's a prescribed burn and not a wildfire.
The East Fork Scott Project has several goals, all tied to reducing wildfire risks and improving forest health.
The East Fork Scott Project, so these two locations are part of that East Fork Scott Project, and they have several objectives. One of them is to protect communities. So when we use prescribed fire, it consumes surface fuels and some ladder fuels and will reduce the intensity of future wildfires. So that can provide a safe place for our firefighters to take a stand in protecting communities during future wildfire events, and also to improve access and egress during wildfires. Another objective out there is to improve the resilience of the forested ecosystem out there. Again, like I said, when we decrease fuels, it decreases the intensity that a fire will burn with, increasing the likelihood that we'll have an intact forested canopy left behind. And so it makes those stands more resilient to future wildfire efforts, or events, I should say. So decreased fuel loading equals decreased fire severity.
Even with all the planning, prescribed fire is never guaranteed. Conditions can shift quickly, and crews will delay if the weather doesn't line up.
If there is smoke on the road for some reason, which one of the environmental parameters that we include in our prescription is wind direction, so that we don't put smoke into sensitive places like communities or on roads. But in the event that there's smoke on the road, you know, we ask people to please slow down, turn on your headlights, and if you see something that you don't believe is a prescribed burn, please call 911. But definitely, you know, pay attention to what we're putting on our Facebook site. That's the Klamath National Forest Facebook page. And then we'll also have information on InciWeb.
For updates, Erickson recommends checking the Klamath National Forest Facebook page or the Federal Fire Information Site, inciweb.gov. In state news, San Francisco tenants on strike over damages from fire that happened a year ago. KPFA's Brianna Vasquez reports.
Union! Power! Union! Power! Union! Power! Union! Power! Power!
Yeah! 907! Claiming months of neglect by Mosser, a San Francisco real estate firm, tenants have been working with the House Rights Committee of San Francisco to bring attention to the issues and hopefully pressure the landlord to meet their demands. They say Mosser has not just neglected the damaged repairs, but also blatantly refused the tenants' demands, citing Mosser's lawyer stating, quote, "We will not sign," end quote, when tenants tried to negotiate. Haley Meyerhoff is tenant organizer at the Housing Rights Committee and lead organizer for the 907 Valencia Tenants on Rent Strike.
We're an organization that supports tenants to improve their conditions and to stay in their homes. We fight against displacement in San Francisco area. So it's now been over a year since that fire, and the tenants have received nothing but neglect while they have continued to pay rent checks to Mosser. Right after the fire, tenants heard absolutely nothing from the landlord. There was one tenant who was relocated to another Mosser unit in a different building at the same rate of rent, but 2 months later, in April, they all received temporary eviction notices. They're saying right now, enough is enough. We want the fire damage repaired. We want our in-unit repairs addressed, and we want to be compensated for the time that we have spent living in a building with a giant hole in the wall because of a fire that happened more than a year ago.
Since July of last year, tenants say Mosser has refused to negotiate any agreement between the tenants and has even sent out eviction notices while only giving tenants 45 days to relocate. They say not only has Mosser failed to provide repairs, it has also left tenants to deal with broken appliances and pest infestations in their homes, while at the same time renovating vacant apartments. Luz Avila is a tenant at 907 Valencia.
There was a terrible rat infestation, and cockroaches too, and they canceled our mail. We didn't receive mail for almost a month. And there have been many things they have not respected. They have not respected us as tenants. And it's not like we failed to pay rent. They have barely been repairing for a week, but they are repairing the apartments that are empty. And we have lived here for more than 30 years. We still have the same stove and still the same fridge. So now they are more concerned about the empty places than about the tenants who live here. And so now we've made a union of neighbors to go on a rent strike until they hear our demand.
Since the fire incident of last year, tenants say there has been no housing manager in the building to fix these issues or any issues that have arisen since then, leaving many tenants to repair damages on their own or risk months of delayed action by the landlord. Tenants have stated, quote, "This is not just a building. This is our home. This is our community," end quote. And during these next few days, they hope to bring pressure to Mosser and have their demands met. Reporting for KPFA News, I'm Brianna Vasquez.
In national native news, Antonio Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Chandler Museum in Arizona has a new exhibit called Being Eddie Basha. It's a retrospective of the hometown-turned statewide grocer who died in 2013. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
Chandler Museum's storytelling coordinator, Sarah Biggerstaff, literally leaned on Basha's own words for one interactive display.
This is our telephone. There's about 20 clips, and they range from like 20 seconds to a minute. You can pick it up, give it a couple seconds, but then you hear him actually speaking. And at our opening, it was really moving.
I would want my epitaph to say, Eddie Basha, he was a good man but a bad boy, and that's how I want to be remembered.
Another one of his principles was putting people over profits. The great-grandson of Lebanese immigrants brought his family brand to tribal lands, beginning in 1981 with the Dines supermarket in Chinle. Basha even committed 25 cents of every dollar to the Navajo Nation.
And of course, the relationship with the Navajo became extremely powerful and fruitful and still exists today.
From Tuba City to Window Rock, stores kept popping up. More locations would follow on Apache land in Parada and White River. The one-time gubernatorial candidate was also an avid collector of Western and American Indian art. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Athletes, coaches, and spectators crowded Main Street in downtown Whitehorse Saturday for the closing ceremonies of the Arctic Winter Games, also known as the Olympics of the North. And Team Alaska had a lot to celebrate. Among the six Arctic nations, it led the Ulu Count medal shaped like curved knives, emblematic of Arctic life. Alaska had 227 Ulus, followed by Team Yukon with 174, and Alberta North with 127. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, Parker Kennick of Nome took home three gold Ulus and many lessons about life.
Parker Kennick started learning traditional Alaska Native games when he was eight, but didn't take part in the Arctic Winter Games until later in life. This year, he competed in the adult category and won gold Ulus in the two-foot high kick, the Alaskan high kick, and the one-hand reach. Kennick says he's grateful for community support that made it possible for him to travel to the games.
Our spirits get lifted here because there's so many people that want to see us do our best to our absolute limit.
Kennick competed in his first Arctic Winter Games in 2023 and says he was lucky to be mentored by some of the best Indigenous athletes in the world. But now he's returning the favor. One of his coaches, Candace Parker, says when Kennick first started out, he was quiet and kept to himself. But today, he readily volunteers to coach the younger athletes.
I would say full circle moment for him to be out on the floor passing on the knowledge and encouraging the athletes. May not have been technical, but doing more encouraging.
Parker says young people can be self-absorbed, but the games teach them to think beyond themselves. She says it's an important exercise in humility, one that athletes like Kennick have embraced. Parker has been coaching since 1996 and says this year she reached an important milestone, having three generations of her family compete in this year's Arctic Winter Games. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez. And thanks to our reporters, Brianna Vasquez and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org. And now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.